would like justice for her. I know many of you want the same thing that I do. I want the violence to stop.
Just by showing up, we prevent these cowards from trying to take the streets.
We're just wanting the government to take responsibility for this situation and take a look at what's really going on.
So what's the easiest solution is to actually stand for the word community and give communities the control of their stations in order to be able to deliver on the Broadcast Act, which says that community broadcasters are one of the three pillars. You cannot have a complete Broadcast Act and or real democracy if there is no separation between community broadcasters and private broadcasters.
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This episode of Groundwire was produced by volunteers at Kootenai Co-op Radio on Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, BC. In this episode, Groundwire attended the 26th annual Women's Memorial March for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women in Vancouver's downtown east side on February 14th. Sophie Morasti spoke at the event about her sister, Rose Morasti, who was murdered in Blood Alley 25 years ago. Her message to those assembled at the march was that violence against Indigenous women has to stop and the Canadian government and people need to make changes.
This month, the BC government will be putting the new Water Sustainability Act into effect, which means that over the next 3 years, groundwater users will be expected to apply for licenses and groundwater will be regulated for the first time in the history of British Columbia. However, it's not clear that the legislation will protect local users of water. Groundwire spoke with K.L. Keevy from the Blewett Conservation Society about what may be a precedent-setting situation in southeastern B.C.
On the Community Radio Report, Ome Salman Rahemtula brings us voices from the recent CRTC Community and Local Television hearing, focusing on examples and lessons learned from community radio.
But first, here are the headlines. On February 6th, close to 200 anti-racist and anti-fascist activists came out in Montreal to disrupt an event planned by the Islamophobic group Pegida. Pegida, a far-right wing group with roots in Germany, has branches in several Canadian cities. However, their attempts to rear their heads on this side of the pond have been met with fierce resistance. At the rally in Montreal, part of an international day of action called by Pegida, only 7 members showed up. 4 managed to read a short statement in front of Justin Trudeau's riding office behind a heavy police cordon, while another 3 were quickly chased away by protesters. This rally, the third Pegida has tried to organize after being shut down twice by anti-racist protest in 2015, was called in the Montreal neighborhood of Villeray, a neighborhood with a large working-class immigrant population. Here is Jaggi Singh, one of the organizers of the counter-protest in Montreal.
So Pegida, Quebec, which is part of the International Pegida, a racist group, an Islamophobic group, a group that basically blames all of society's problems on the backs of Muslims. This group is trying to demonstrate here in the heart of Villeray, just 3 blocks that way. Their demonstration is supposed to start at 3. Their people are arriving around now, around 2:15, 2:30. But if experience teaches us anything, just like we did back in September and just like we did back in March, just by showing up, we prevent these cowards from trying to take the streets. Our plan today is rather simple. We get on the streets, we march towards their location, and we hold our ground and make sure that they don't demonstrate towards here. Keep in mind that we also have other comrades somewhere around the neighborhood that will be around as well, so they'll be taking care of business as well.
Pegida actions on that same day were also disrupted by anti-fascist groups in Ireland, England, France, and the Netherlands. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back.
And you just heard the track Jazz Hands. And that was just one sample from the NCRA's newly released CD, Unloggable Music Under a Minute, which is available at the website ncra.ca.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
Gunnar G. O'Sullivan attended the 26th annual Women's Memorial March for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women in Vancouver's downtown east side. In this feature, you'll hear Sophie Morasti speaking about her sister Rose, who was murdered in Blood Alley in Vancouver 25 years ago. Sophie's message to the crowd was that violence against Indigenous women has to stop, and the Canadian government and people need to make changes. After you hear Sophie speaking, you'll hear Gennarji O'Sullivan and Danielle Carr in the studios at Vancouver Co-op Radio speaking after the march.
My name is Sophie Morasti, and I'm of the Denisilini and Cree Nation of Northern Manitoba at the tip of Reindeer Lake. I want to acknowledge the Goosen people of the Slaver Truth, of Musqueam and Squamish Nation, whose territory I'm on. This is my sister, Rose Morasti. She was killed in the downtown east side here 25 years ago. Her body was found in Blood Alley, broken, and she died in a very undignified way. She was nude from the waist down. And at that time, I was in shock and in a lot of pain, and I tried to get a police report and a coroner's report, and I still don't have one. There's been no closure around my sister's death. She left 5 children behind. 3 of them were put into, taken away, and the ministry took them. My sister had a lot of pain in her life. I would say that it wasn't just the man that was involved in her death that killed her. I would say that it was a whole system. It was abuse of men. It was the Roman Catholic Church. It was intergenerational trauma. It was sexual abuse and rape. It was violence against her. And it was CFS who took her children away. The man that killed my sister served a month in the holding cell down here while he was waiting for trial. I never got a call from the Crown Prosecutor as to when the trial would be. I never saw his face. And they released him after 30 days. They said that was time served. I feel a real sense of injustice around her death. There's been a big gap in the lives of my family, myself, and her children. There's been no closure. I don't like how the police didn't investigate her death thoroughly. I don't like how the justice system treats her and many of our women. I don't like the racism and the sexism and the misogynist attitudes towards our women. My message here today is that this violence against our women has got to stop. I want the Canadian government to start making changes and active changes. I want the Canadian society to be educated on the history of our people and stop having these racist views against us and stop dehumanizing our women. I miss my sister. I've never spoken up publicly about her death. This is the first time. I would like justice for her. I know many of you want the same thing that I do. I want the violence to stop.
Well, we just heard from Sophie Moreste how the perpetrator only got 30 days in jail, and she still hasn't received a coroner report. And then another elder talked about how her son, his remains, his skull was found 30 years later. She's waited 30 years to find out what happened to her son. 2 weeks ago, they found his skull. And she said the pain never goes away. It really, really hurts. And she wishes that the government of Canada would do more. They keep saying that they will, but she really doesn't believe in them anymore. She's lost faith. you know, and that is important for people to realize as well, you know.
Yeah, I did see a lot of people came out with signs and drums. Traffic was blocked off to let the people march. And a lot of the signs had the word no justice on it, because mm-hmm. I think that's how a lot of people felt.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. But one of the other beautiful moments were when they would stop the march, and the women, the elders, would do a ceremony. They would bring flowers to the spot where a missing woman or a murdered woman had been found. They would put flowers, red and yellow flowers, on the sidewalk or in the alley. They would put 6 candles, light them up, and they would sprinkle sage and cedar and tobacco in honor of those missing and murdered women. And that was a beautiful ceremony to witness.
I agree. I thought that was really beautiful as well. And when I was interviewing people there, I was actually walking and talking while we were doing the interview, which is kind of interesting. But always when it got to that moment where people had to lay the flowers, they're like, okay, hold on a second. I got to go do this first, and then I'll come back and talk to you, because people wanted to be part of that ceremony.
Beautiful. Okay, let's hear what you have.
All right, here's what some of the people had to say at the march.
Randy, I'm here on behalf of my auntie Jacqueline Murdoch. She was murdered. She's one of the missing women. She got picked up by the Penticton farmer. They found her remains. So that's why I'm here, for my auntie. My son says, we want change. We march in honor of our lost loved ones. We will be idle no more.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My name is Ruth Sims. I drove here from Seattle, Washington this morning, and I came in support of missing and murdered Indigenous women. My sign here says 4% of FEMA population is Indigenous Canadian females, and 23% of those Indigenous Canadian females are also female homicide victims. And I think things like that are not really well known, that it's such a high rate. And I think it's important for people to come out and support that and learn about it.
Is this their first event that you've come to?
No, this is the second one, but I think it's been going on for a number of years.
Since this is your second event, what brought you the first time? When did you hear about it?
Last year I met a woman by the name of Lillian Howard, who works here down with anybody working in the sex trade. She basically goes around and does sort of outreach and tries to get women into programs that are that can transition them out of the industry and off of the streets.
And what's the key message you think the community should know about this event?
I think the key message is people to understand that there are so many lost and murdered and missing Indigenous women, and they are part of this community, whether people realize it or not. And it doesn't just affect them, it affects everyone within the community, the police, the other people who still live here, the families, the friends, anyone who knew that person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Gennargio Sullivan of Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, for the audio used in that report.
The next story comes to us from southeastern British Columbia. Catherine Fisher spoke with K.L. Keevy from the Blewett Conservation Society about BC's new Water Sustainability Act and what may be a precedent-setting situation in the small BC community of Blewett.
The Blewett Conservation Society is concerned about the impact a water bottling plant owned by Oakenshaw Water Limited could have on local residents in the small BC community of Blewett, near Nelson, BC, on the south side of the Kootenay River. Oakenshaw has been extracting groundwater and selling it to international markets for private profit for several years. One of the Society's concerns is about how Oakenshaw describes the aquifer versus the data that the BC Minister of the Environment has on it.
The Oakenshaw website has characterized the aquifer as being in a completely wooded, non-residential catchment area of 37 square kilometers. The government reports say that the aquifer itself is 11 square kilometers in fractured rock. Oakenshaw has characterized the aquifer as being a big lake underground. So there's definitely conflicting information coming about the aquifer itself.
K.L. Keevy spoke with Groundwire about the potential impact about Oakenshaw's water extraction on Blewett domestic water users and the ecosystem. The Society is also concerned about some lack of clarity in BC's new Water Sustainability Act. The Society wants the BC government to apply the new regulations in a very clear way that recognizes local water users have priority over commercial users exporting water.
This month, any day now, the government will be putting the new Water Sustainability Act legislation into effect, which means that over the next 3 years, groundwater users will be expected to apply for licenses, and those licenses will be granted, and groundwater will be regulated for the first time in the history of British Columbia. However, it's not clear that the legislation will protect local users of water, so it's unclear, basically. And what we're asking for is that the regulations within the Water Sustainability Act be applied in a very clear way that recognizes that local users of water, domestic users, have priority over people that are extracting water or companies that are extracting water for export. And in order to do that, there needs to be adequate information. So we're launching a petition this week, and this petition basically requests that the government do a third-party assessment of the aquifer before any licenses are granted, and that there be a water sustainability plan by the community, which involves participation from the community, set in place. It's not that we're saying under no conditions must there be a water bottling plant. We're saying that any license that are granted must take into consideration both concrete information about the aquifer itself, not just guesses or suppositions, must include monitoring. They must be reviewable so that if in the future climatic conditions continue to change, if there's not enough water for domestic users, that those are a priority. And those licenses granted for things like water bottling must be revocable. It's good that there's new water sustainability legislation, and we're just wanting the government to take responsibility for this situation and take a look at what's really going on and not grant a license without adequate information and adequate public consultation. Some of the coastal organizations that deal with water, like the Freshwater Alliance and the Council of Canadians, are very interested in what's going on in Blewett right now because it's timed so closely with the launching of the Water Sustainability Act. And so we're in conversation with those folks about, you know, using the situation here as an example of, you know, how are we going to proceed with the Water Sustainability Act in this current climate.
Kivi also spoke of the BC Council of Indian Chiefs' recent statement that there has been inadequate consultation with First Nations around the province as regards developing the new Water Sustainability Act.
One of the significant concerns around the province is that the act is designed in such a way that license will be granted first in time, first in line. So the people who had certain wells before will have right to be first in line in terms of licenses. This, however, does not apply to First Nations in British Columbia. And the BC Council of Indian Chiefs has made a statement saying that there has been inadequate consultation with First Nations across the province around the Water Sustainability Act. Here, we're of course dealing with a very special issue in that the Senaiksht, our local First Nation, isn't even recognized by the government. And so even if those kinds of consultations were going on, the Senaiksht would still not be considered here. Marilyn James has spoken very often about the importance of water to the Senaiksht and the key importance of protecting that resource in particular.
You're listening to Groundwire. That was K.L. Kivi from the Blewett Conservation Society.
And That was Cozy Father, again from the NCRA's Unlockable music compilation. Now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report.
In our Community Radio Report, we hear interventions from the CRTC community and local television hearing, focusing on examples and lessons learnt from community radio.
Last year, the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, or the CRTC, launched a review of their community and local television policy. As part of the review, community organizations, corporations and individuals were welcome to submit submissions regarding their opinions on what should be considered in the review of the policies that govern community and local television in Canada. Organizations with interests in community radio, such as the National Campus Community Radio Association, the NCRA, as well as organizations that turn to community radio as an example for directions around ownership and access for community television, made interventions at the review's public hearing from January 25th to February 3rd in Gatineau. Barry Rook, the executive director of the NCRA, spoke to me about the NCRA's intervention at the hearing.
One was specifically around who it is that sort of controls the media and the ownership of the organization. And the radio sector is very focused on a not-for-profit basis. All members of ours, let alone someone who holds a CRTC license, has to be a not-for-profit organization with a specific setup for their board of directors. So the community TV side doesn't necessarily have that requirement. So we thought it was important to make sure that we reference that that's how it is happening here on our side of things, and then that it does work. There are challenges, but the systems in place are designed to be able to deal with those challenges. The second sort of comments were around the access to being able to produce content and programming. Most of the programming done on radio at the community level is produced by volunteers. There's very little that is actually done on the paid staffing side. Just the structure and the amount of funding available to stations doesn't really allow it. And most stations understand and realize that there is the importance, and that is their mandate, is to have the voice of the community allowing to create that production and have their say. Almost all of the work is being done at the community level by volunteers, whereas that necessarily isn't the case when it comes to community television. So we thought it was really important to highlight that area.
The following clips from the hearing pointed to other lessons that can be gleaned from the community radio experience. The Community Media Advocacy Center mentioned the success community radio has had in terms of logging different types of programming as a way to assure accountability of representation by marginalized communities.
I do believe that the policy can put forward those kinds of content categories that would ideally represent the community being served, the linguistic, the ethnic makeup, the indigenous makeup of communities being served. So to back up the policy with logs that enumerate the kinds of content being aired.
And if we could add that it's not novel to suggest that kind of logging. I mean, it's already done in terms of community radio, where you have different categories for local and CanCon and so forth, and how do we measure different types of third languages being represented.
ICTV Montreal spoke to the quick ways in which the CRTC responds to non-compliance by the community radio sector, but fails to do so when broadcast distribution undertakings or BDU-operated community television stations are non-compliant.
Currently, the main problem is that BDUs have first dibs over the community television license. And there's practically never been any BDU that's been held responsible for their non-compliance in terms of the community television. Well, we know that from the community radio sector, for instance, the CRTC, whenever a community radio station violates the policy of community radio, is very quick on de-licensing a non-compliant station.
I'm not sure about the very quick, but anyhow, I take your point.
Yeah, we have the case of CKLN in Toronto, which was one of the oldest community radio stations that lost its station within 9 months of it being found in non-compliance. Mm-hmm. So now we have in this...
There was a lot of history before that.
Yes, but we have also a history of 20 years of BDUs standing in violations of the regulation. So what's the easiest solution is to actually stand for the word community and give communities the control of their stations in order to be able to deliver on the Broadcast Act, which says that community broadcasters are one of the three pillars. You cannot have a complete Broadcast Act and or real democracy if there is no separation between community broadcasters and private broadcasters.
Finally, the CRTC hearing was also an opportunity for organizations to present new visions for the inclusion of diverse communities in television production that would generate a truly grassroots, accessible, and non-corporate model for community and local television. The Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations, CACTUS, put forward a proposal for the creation of community access media centres that would bring together community radio, television, and other forms of media production.
Other countries have tended to steam ahead because community media has always been viewed as defined by community ownership. So there's been natural partnerships arisen, for example, between community television and community radio and institutions like public libraries in other jurisdictions. So, for example, the nearest one in Grand Rapids, Michigan, is actually a community media center hosted within a public library that has a cable broadcasting license for TV. It has an over-the-air radio channel. It's got a live theater where actors in the community can rent plays. They can have town hall debates and all have it televised from that facility. And there's also neighborhood satellite facilities around Grand Rapids as well that are all linked together. So citizens can produce at different hubs and have it all be transmitted on these multiple media. So those are the kinds of models that we think are forward-looking and progressive for Canada.
Reporting for Groundwire from the CRTC hearing on the review of the policy framework for local and community television programming in Gatineau, Quebec, on Algonquin territory, this is Ome Salma Rahimtullah.
And that's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by volunteers at Kootenai Co-op Radio CJLY on Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, BC. This week's headlines were written by Aaron Lakoff and Catherine Fisher. We also thank Ome Salma Rahimtullah, Gunnergy O'Sullivan, and Matt Willish.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station on the Rabble Podcast Network or download at groundwire.ncra.ca.